Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Kathy Hochul signed a controversial bill this week requiring safeguards for AI models. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Tech companies will have to tell state regulators about their safety protocols before models are released. Under the new law, they'll also have to report any lapses, like a model operating without human direction, within 72 hours. The Democratic governor signed the RAISE Act after intense lobbying from the AI industry. She took out a provision that would have blocked the release of a model if there was an unreasonable security risk. But in doing so, Hochul brought New York's regulations in line with a new California law. She says that's important since there aren't federal rules.
In the absence of any kind of real leadership out of Washington, then it's up to states to lead.
AI companies say the RAISE Act strikes a balance between safety and innovation. The new law takes effect in March. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Earlier this year, Texas-based Avelo Airlines began contracting with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to operate deportation flights out of the U.S. While there's no indication any of these flights are originating from Albany International Airport, several advocates and lawmakers have launched efforts to ground Avelo's Capital Region operations. But as the Legislative Gazette's Sagina Shrestha reports, not everyone agrees with the efforts.
Leila Kios is the operational lead for Indivisible Albany, the main local advocacy group pushing for Avelo's departure. Kios says although Avelo does not directly carry deportation flights out of New York State, the company's broader actions directly impact Albany.
It's important that they leave because Avelo receives benefits from operating out of Albany County Airport, and a company that is complicit with the destruction of democracy, with the destruction of constitutional rights that people have in this country, should not be entitled to the benefit of a community that they're dismantling, essentially.
Indivisible Albany is part of a larger nationwide movement to pressure airports to cut ties with Avelo as a result of their affiliation with ICE. They have staged protests at the airport and are now pushing the Albany County Legislature to take action. Last month, 8 legislators signed on to a statement urging the Albany County Airport Authority Board to pressure Avelo to cease local operations. Separate from this activism, Albany State Senator Patricia Fahey, a Democrat, has introduced legislation that would remove Avelo's tax incentives for operating out of the Albany International Airport. Still, not everyone supports taking a stance against Avelo. For its part, the airport said in a statement that federal law bars the airport from discriminating against airlines without reasonable cause. In a statement to WAMC, the county legislature's Democratic majority leader, Dennis Feeney, said ending the Albany Airport's contract with the airline could have financial consequences. It would cost Albany County taxpayers around $50 million. Feeney did not elaborate on how he got to that number. Paul Bergdorf, the Republican county legislator who represents the 23rd District, says he worries about increasing airfares if Avelo departs.
And that competition is what makes air traffic more affordable. If you did not have the competition, there would be a monopoly for one carrier to charge whatever they want.
Bergdorf said he's also concerned about some people's personal beliefs impacting how others choose to fly.
People have a right to vote for whoever they want, but you do not have a right to disenfranchise me or stop me from using a legitimate, high-quality air service across the United States.
Democratic County Legislator Samuel Fine is one of the 8 lawmakers to sign the statement to the Albany County Airport Authority Board. He says even if flying with Avelo is a personal choice, that personal choice has a broader community impact.
Well, I think, you know, just as we can personally choose which airline we want to fly as, I think as a community, we can choose what our values are, and we can decide, you know, which airlines that we want to support as a community, and we can make a choice to not support businesses that are committing inhumane acts and acting in unconstitutional ways.
The statement that Fine and others signed commended Fahey for introducing the Safe Air Act in May. The bill aims to prevent airlines engaging in deportation flights from taking advantage of New York State's tax credits for jet fuel purchases. It also calls for prohibiting New York State agencies and local governments from working with commercial airlines that contract with ICE. Fahey said this bill was a way to work around potential federal law violations by using the state's powers to take a stance.
But it really is about not having our tax dollars subsidizing private sector businesses that are participating in or even indirectly aiding these immigration enforcement actions that are undermining traditional law enforcement and violating fundamental due process rights of individuals.
Fine added that Fahey's proposal, along with county legislators' actions, can present a clear statement to Avello.
If airports throughout the country take action and say we're not willing to work with Avello, we're not willing to have flights from Avello at our airports, Avello will be hurt economically, and they will. There's a good chance they'll backtrack and they'll cancel this agreement.
In a statement to WAMC, an Avello spokesperson said, quote, "We recognize the right of individuals to peacefully assemble. Avello's main priority continues to be maintaining the safety and timeliness of our operation that over 8 million customers across the country continue to enjoy." Kios, the advocate with Indivisible, says she has not been satisfied with the county's actions so far. She says the legislature was able to successfully lobby the airport to take down a controversial TSA video in which Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem blamed Democrats during the government shutdown. She believes local leaders can do more regarding Avello.
So don't tell me that there's no power here. And if they truly have no legislative power around this, they could do the bare minimum, which they're not doing.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sajina Shrestha.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Paul Wolf, President Emeritus of the New York Coalition for Open Government, to ask him about why Governor Hochul ended up on their naughty list this year.
Yeah, it's disappointing that that's the case, but when she came into office as governor, she stated that she was going to bring a new era of transparency, and unfortunately, she talked a good game but hasn't backed it up. So not much has come from the governor in terms of initiatives for open government, and anytime the legislature passes a bill that would reform things, she seems to veto it. So she was put on the list this year for vetoing several bills that we supported.
Well, let's talk about those bills. They're very important. And of course, one of them was tightening FOIL response deadlines, freedom of information law we're talking about. This is very valuable to regular citizens, of course, but I'll be honest with you, to the media. And we often don't get timely replies.
Yes, that is true. All across the state, we hear complaints from the news media and the public as far as how long it takes or how difficult it is to obtain information through a Freedom of Information Law request. So one of the bills would have put some tighter time periods in there. One of the problems we see is a public agency will ask for more time. You know, you get a letter every 60 days, we need more time. And this could go on for months. So this bill would have put some time limits in place. Seemed pretty reasonable, but the governor vetoed it.
Again, after a campaign in which she said they'd be the most transparent administration in New York has ever seen. So tell us about the other bills you're not so happy about.
Well, just the other day, actually after our list came out, she has vetoed the bill regarding police radio transmissions. There's a growing movement across the state of police agencies encrypting their scanners, which the media relies on. There was a bill about getting more information regarding limited liability companies. Many of those are secret as far as who owns certain properties or businesses. The governor just vetoed that bill. So the list, unfortunately, goes on and on.
That's Paul Wolf, President Emeritus of the New York Coalition for Open Government. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. During their meeting this month, the Olympic Regional Development Authority Board discussed the possibility of retaining a consultant to review current and future venue maintenance needs. The Adirondack Explorer's James Odato recently reported about how the vote signifies that the state authority with 1,500 employees may not be properly equipped or sufficiently staffed to run its $625 million winter sports facilities, which include Bel Air, Gore Mountain, and the Lake Placid Olympic venues. Odato detailed his reporting with the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
What I made of the debate is that there was an extraordinary meeting in which board members queried a resolution and showed a fair amount of reluctance to go along with a resolution. So as a result, the resolution was tabled because it was clear that there was going to be at best a divided vote, if not a losing vote. The board's going to try to figure out whether it's something that's feasible, given it's a $3 million expense. For a report. It's supposed to be a roadmap for decades. The people who are pitching it as necessary are the CEO and the chairman, and the rank and file board members are dubious. They're not sure this is something that they want to go along with. They want more information. There was a fair amount of questioning of this proposal.
James, you've mentioned the cost of it. Do you think ORDA has overextended itself?
The board didn't talk about the fact that they now have three ski centers to deal with as opposed to two, and how they've been building up their existing franchise with improvements and things like that. No one said that they believe that this is too much to take on, but what they did say, what the CEO and the chairman were indicating, is that the staff that is running the facilities is busy. They don't really have time for the planning that would be necessary. It's not clear as to whether they have the talent or the training either. But this is a big operation now. They have come up with a fresh information which indicates that it's worth $625 million in insured value. And the insurance company that valued it didn't even take into account assets that were worth $150,000 and less. And there are a lot of those kind of assets as well. So this is a franchise that has been built up to be worth well over $625 million. And they want to make sure that their maintenance apparatus is able to keep it going on a regular basis, and that as they add in the future and plan for the future, you know, at new events and new activities and ways to keep it a 12-month-a-year operation, that they've got a plan. And the CEO and the chairman of the Olympic Regional Development Authority do not believe that that plan can be constructed with the staff they have now, that they think it's necessary to retain a consultant to do this work.
James, did you get a chance to talk to any of the ORDA employees about what they think of bringing in a consultant to review what they're capable of doing?
The people I have talked to in the ORDA community are of the same opinion as the board members who are questioning whether this can't be done with the current staff or why it needs to be done outside the current staff. But there are other public authorities that I have talked to as well. major public authorities that actually make money as opposed to lose money. And they are not aware of hiring out for a consultant for a strategic plan as the Olympic Regional Development Authority is proposing to do. This is not something I've heard other authorities doing.
The resolution was tabled to obtain more information before the board's next regularly scheduled meeting in March.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. 34 years after New York State first introduced Gold Star Mother license plates, Gold Star families are now also able to apply for license plates in honor of the soldiers and their families who lost their lives while serving. The Legislative Gazette's Mariam Ahmad has more.
It's definitely been a long wait, and I'm just ecstatic to finally put that on my truck and finally just have this done.
Adam DeMarsico is a former resident of Massachusetts, where he had a Gold Star family plate in honor of his brother, Army Specialist Michael DeMarsico, who was killed in Afghanistan in 2012. But when DeMarsico moved to Cohoes, there was no option for him to get a Gold Star family plate through the New York Department of Motor Vehicles. DeMarsico approached State Senator Jake Ashby, who worked with Assemblymember John McDonald, to make the Gold Star family plate available to any immediate family member of soldiers who lost their lives in the line of duty. Ashby said the plate was a way to honor the sacrifice soldiers make for the country.
I think this is very important for every citizen in the United States because the country that we live in today was really born through the sacrifices of those who gave everything for us. And this is just a small way for the manifestation of that memory.
Ashby said many supporters, along with DeMarsico, contributed to the campaign.
A lot of veterans from around the area, from American Legions to VFWs, to those who, you know, just independently supported it, signed petitions, wrote DMV. DMV had moved pretty quickly for a bureaucratic office in the state of New York, and we're very grateful for that. So it was truly a team effort.
New York State has had the option to apply for a Gold Star Mother plate since 1991, but has not had that option available to siblings, fathers, or children. Carrie Farley, a Gold Star mother, who is the president of the Albany chapter of the American Gold Star Mothers, said that their loss deserves to be recognized by the state as well.
I have a Gold Star Mother plate, and I'm proud to show that. It takes a family to raise a soldier. It takes a family to grieve a soldier.
Farley said she hoped the plate would be made more affordable for families who are grieving, as the current plate does require a renewal fee every year. Farley's son, Staff Sergeant Derek John Farley, was killed in 2010.
Many years later, 15 years later, I have found strength with the Mothers, an organization that has been around since World War I. And we do these things. We support each other. It's like no other to be with someone that has lost a child.
DeMarsico remembered his brother fondly and said that he was dedicated to his country.
So my brother was an outgoing guy. After 9/11 happened, I think we were like 9. And my brother always said since that day that he was going to go serve his country and this is what he wanted to do and he was going to go to war. And that was the life that he chose. And we didn't really believe it at first until he actually did go. And he came home for Christmas. And unfortunately, that was the last time we saw him.
After 2 years of working toward it, DeMarsico finally has a New York issued Gold Star family license plate.
So it's just a way to remember my brother. You know, he's not with us to travel with me. But with a Gold Star license plate, it feels like he's still with me. So wherever I go, I feel safe.
I'm Mariam Ahmad.
An early 20th century structure in Greenwich, New York, houses generations of firefighting memorabilia that some residents are hoping can help inspire the next generation of volunteer crews. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella-Levine picks up the story.
Originally built in 1904, the two-story brick building that once served as Greenwich's jail in addition to its volunteer firehouse now stands frozen in time. This time of year, the rough-and-ready building also stands literally frozen. And while the community recently crowdsourced nearly $40,000 to replace the decaying windows in the old firehouse, there's still no central heating, or central anything for that matter.
I'm sorry. 3 feet from the kitchen sink is the toilet. I can't prepare my food and get rid of it in the same room.
Gary St. Mary has been a volunteer firefighter for nearly 5 decades. His father before him was a firefighter, and now his son is a firefighter. He's among a handful of community members vying to turn the building into a full-blown museum, in part to help inspire young visitors to join the long lineage of volunteer firefighters serving the Washington County Village.
It's beautiful. The condition it was in, it needed some love. We gave it some love. But as far as structural, we haven't done anything to change the structure of the building or, you know, layout. It's all the way it was originally.
The 2B Museum already has an impressive collection of vintage firefighting equipment, from hand-pulled hose carts to buckets with their bottoms rounded out as an early theft prevention method. Most striking, however, is the intact hand-pumped fire engine.
And you got to remember, this unit always went to the water source, whether it was a stream, a pond, the river, whatever. And then the guys on these hose carts would hook up, run to the fire, get the nozzles on the hoses, send a runner back to say, okay, you can start pumping. And then if they didn't have enough guys yet, what they'd do is they'd pump up, pump down, and step down. So hopefully by the time they got to the other end of this thing, there was a line back here to give you a break. If not, you got right back in line and got pumping again. That's how these guys all had those barrel chests. They didn't have to go to the gym to work out back then.
Greg Dorisky is president of the Rough and Ready Engine and Hose Company No. 2, the organization working to conserve the building, which was a working fire station until the mid-1900s. Volunteer firefighters currently work out of a station half a mile down the road. The 28-foot-long engine weighs in at 4,700 pounds and was purchased by the Rough and Ready Engine Company in 1899 for $800. Large brakes on each side allowed for up to 60 men to pump it at once. Picture a massive seesaw. And an extension of rope off the front allowed as many people as possible to help pull it. A giant brass orb sits in the middle. St. Mary explains its purpose.
The big brass ball on the top is if you have a modern well at your house, 10 to 1 you have what they call a pressure tank. And that is basically what that big brass ball is. The water would come in the bottom of it, try to compress the air in the top of it, and it would smooth out the stream of water because it's a positive displacement pump. It's a piston pump, and the piston will spurt water. When the piston pushes, it spurts the water. And then there's a lull in between the other piston pushing. Trying to compress the air in the bulb smooths it out so it's less spurting.
The engine was refitted in 1926 for competition and, in its prime, sent a 1-inch stream of water 232 feet. The building's first floor also hosts a variety of antique firefighter toys and early fire extinguishers. Visitors can scan QR codes to be sent to the museum's YouTube page for in-depth explanations. There's also a selection of alarms, including a giant triangle. And if you look closely, you'll see a line of rope running up through the first and second floors to the roof, where, back in the day, it could be pulled to ring a bell. And yes, they kept the bell too. The second floor has 2 pianos, marching band instruments, and was where firefighters held dances and concerts. It's also where volunteers have on display a variety of items belonging to the village's chapter of the Independent Order of Odd Fellows. Think a more peculiar Elks, Masons, or Knights of Columbus.
Their purpose was to protect the widows and orphans, to bury the dead, to help each other in want, to counsel each other in difficult...
There's a vast collection of Odd Fellow memorabilia, including a casket with a model skeleton named George that St. Mary and Dorisky found under a staircase when they opened up the firehouse in 2020.
They were a faith-based organization. The Independent Order of Odd Fellows, their insignia was 3 chain links, faith, love, and truth, okay? And they protected and educated the orphans and, you know, unwanted children. They, back in the 1800s, this really surprised me reading through their records, they provided a home for the aged, okay? And in the 1800s, they had sick pay.
Dariski tells WAMC they're working through the process to become a registered 501c3, and they're finalists for the current round of New York Forward funds, which the state has set aside to help revitalize smaller and rural communities.
And we've put in for a bathroom, handicap bathroom, water, sewer, a new power panel, heating and air conditioning, and a stair chair, a lift chair to get people up and down the stairs. So if we get any money at all, that's what our projects are. And then depending on what New York State deems we're worthy of receiving, we'll go from there.
St. Mary's got high hopes for the building and the prospects of turning it into a proper museum. Mostly, though, he just likes sharing the village's firefighting history.
Well, volunteer fireman age is 16 in New York State. 18 before you can go interior and actually fight fire. But, yeah, I would enjoy educating the younger generations, whether it be school students or college students or just Joe off the street.
Dariski says when they're open regularly during the summers, they can get up to 15 visitors a day. With the planned improvements, he expects that number to keep growing.
People should care because this is firefighting history. Any firefighter, once it's in their blood, they're going to die being a firefighter. That's just the way it is. And when we're out to the Washington County Fair, we have a lot of other firemen that come from other departments that, again, we didn't know it was here. We didn't know this stuff existed, all that kind of stuff.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2552. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.